So we're here at the Rabbi's Table, and we've got this amazing guest, Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, where I'd like to start talking, if that's okay with you, is in your new film, and again, I want to mention to everyone, they really should check out your new podcast, Dinesh. I think it's an important thing, instead of doing a daily podcast that you used to be doing once a week, but to make it even more meaningful and deeper. And I think that would be, I've listened to a number of them. I think it would behoove people to do that. In your film, The Dragon's Prophecy, you're very clear you reject the idea of a two-state solution. I agree with that 1,000%. A two-state solution will never work. It's never been realistic in my mind, because the Quran this is not a war about land, oil, or anything else. It's a war about theology. So let's start with that. Would you agree that the war that we see going on in the Middle East is and has been a war of theology more than anything else?
Yes, I think we can show that by looking at the roots of radical Islam. If Israel was the provocation for the rise of radical Islam, we might expect radical Islam to germinate and thrive after 1948, for example. But the truth of it is, radical Islam begins in the 7th century with a
so
fury.
Let's stop calling it radical Islam. Let's just call it observant Islam.
True. I do agree with that. I think you would agree that, you know, as you find in Christianity and in Judaism, you have sort of a spectrum of intensity, right? And you've got a certain cadre of, you can call them frontier Muslims, if you want to call them that. These are the people who, in some ways, take the Quran more seriously than everybody else. And they're recognized to do so even by the ordinary, perhaps somewhat lackadaisical, loosely conformist Muslims, which would help to explain why the ordinary Muslims are so deferential towards some of these. So I'm only using radical Islam in that way,
right?
It from Islam, recognizing it is actually tapping into Islam itself for its inspiration. But my point is, these guys, with the fury, they take the Holy Land, they move north into Europe, they move east into Asia, they conquer the northern part of India, they take northern Africa, and they create these multiple Islamic empires, the last of which, of course, is the Ottoman Empire, which ends around World War I. And then when is the Muslim Brotherhood founded? Well, 1928, but pretty much right after that, out of the crisis of Islam, out of an effort to restore this idea of the caliphate, in the case of Shia Islam, to, you know, bring back the 12th Imam, bring back the Mahdi. So yes, I mean, it's quite obvious Israel's not even around. There's no nation of Israel for another 20 years, 1948. So radical, and then even when Khomeini comes to power in Iran, he very clearly says, you know, he says basically, we radical Muslims have finally gotten a hold of a major state. We've always wanted it, and now we have it, and it's going to be the launching pad really for global jihad. Israel is very peripheral to his vision as outlined in a whole series of sermons in the mid to late 1970s. And so you can see here that radical Islam has a much wider compass and orbit. And the Palestinians are just one tool, one useful weapon that they deploy in their vast and varied arsenal.
So let's back up with that for a moment. First of all, I totally agree with you. And we're not talking about Muslims as individuals, but Muslim the tradition. Typically, it doesn't matter if it's Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. 10 to 20% are observant, 80 to 90% are two-day-a-year Jews, two-day-a-year Christians. 80 to 90% of Muslims do not observe the Quran religiously, so to speak. The difference is that those 10% of Muslims means 200 million people who are. And the difference is that the Hebrew and Christian scriptures are about deepening your relationship with God. The Quran is about creating a worldwide caliphate. So, you know, it takes a challenge. But you just mentioned about the Palestinians. So let's talk about that for just a moment, because this idea of a two-state solution. You agree the two-state solution can't work, true?
Yeah, because I think it's been tried.
Okay.
I mean, what was Gaza if not one version of a two-state solution? Hey, people of Gaza, you can choose your own government. They chose Hamas, you know, and look at the fruit of it. So I say it's a failure. It may be a failure conceptually, but it's also quite decisively a failure empirically.
And I think part of it is also that, and I think this is, you know, one of the things that I think we need to really educate people about is there is no such thing as Palestine. There never has been. There was never a king, a country, a flag, a state, a stamp, a coin, or anything else. That after the destruction of the Second Temple, the Romans changed the entire region they called Philistinia, which was not just that area of Israel. It was what is now known as Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, parts of Iraq and Iran. That whole region was called Philistinia, like we call the Midwest, but there, although there are states of Kansas and Missouri, there's never been a state of the Midwest. Similarly, there's never been a state of Philistinia or a state of Palestine. And then when we get to World War I, when the Brits make deals with three different families, that they will be leaders in different countries. And so we have this change, but there's still no Palestine, no Philistinia. It's a British protectorate. That whole region is the British protectorate of Palestine. We've kind of, the world's kind of bought into this big lie. You know, you're very prescient about seeing the big lie and seeing how it's been repeated in that book. I really want to recommend to people as well to understand what we're seeing in the world. That if you do repeat a lie often enough and it's big enough, it'll be listened to. But you and I agree the two-state solution doesn't work. What's your alternative?
My alternative is a one-state solution, which is to say that Israel rules and commands the territory under its control. It doesn't look like Israel has any broader territorial ambition. So Israel's, the land of Israel is, by the way, I came to Israel for the first time in late 2022. I was almost startled to see how tiny it is, how small it is, particularly sort of side to side. I also want to make a point about biblical archaeology that I found very interesting, which is that while there's no doubt that the Jews go back to that land 4,000 years, and there are plenty of historical artifacts coming out of the ground, clay seals, inscriptions, many times descriptions of Israel that are coming not just from the Jews, but coming from people hostile to Israel and therefore carrying a lot of archaeological credibility. But there were no Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, that was Philistine country. The Philistines are Europeans. They came from places like Cyprus and Greece from the Mediterranean. So you have this kind of peculiarity, which is that the Jews are in fact native to the land of Israel, but the Palestinians in Gaza are basically imposters. They are not the original inhabitants of that land.
No, and look, the great grandparents of the people currently living in Gaza call themselves Egyptians. The great grandparents of the people currently living in Judea Samaria call themselves Jordanians. The great grandparents of the people living in the Golan call themselves Syrians. No one called themselves a Palestinian. That concept is actually not created until 1964, where a public relations company is hired by both the Soviet Union and the Arab League, and they come up with this idea, we need a victim, and suddenly Yasser Arafat is the head, an Egyptian, is the head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It's a made-up concept that has been bought into now for over 60 years. So let's kind of try and move a little bit from just the idea of a two-state to one-state, because I agree with you that there really is no option there. I actually think that you could have a three-state solution, which is Israel, the Palestinians in Jordan, wherever you want to be in Jordan, you want to be in Syria, whatever you call yourself, and actually make Gaza into more of an independent nation that is run ultimately by an international organization. Kind of what Trump was saying. I actually wrote an article about it years before he did it. The idea of a Riviera. If you've been to Tel Aviv, you know how great the beach is. Gaza could be the best beach community on the planet with resorts and paid for that way. But this two-state solution will never work, especially when we realize the Quran's goals. So let's back up a little bit before we even get into the war of today. Should all Arab leadership be required to recognize Israel as the Jewish state before we have any negotiations about anything? Because they don't. So should they be forced to do that?
I have to think about this. I don't have a ready answer to it. I do think that Trump's strategy is to wean away, as he sees it, the Muslims we can do business with against the dug-in radicals in Iran. So I think in Trump's view of the world, and I just did a commentary on Trump, by the way, in which I argued that his view of the world is not ideological. It's sort of the real estate man's view of the world. And you confirmed it a moment ago when he looks at Gaza and he sees rubble, you know, he thinks of it like a real estate guy. Well, why are we wasting this beautiful piece of land kind of on the water? Why don't we have some coffee shops and some, you know, tall buildings and people going to work and IT companies, maybe a Trump hotel.
Couple golf courses, yeah.
Yeah, this is the way a real estate guy thinks. I think from Trump's point of view, there are Muslim countries that are interested in robotics, in AI, in cryptocurrency. Trump's views, let's encourage those guys. And in fact, let's try to mobilize those guys. Let's call them the Muslims of the future against these sort of 7th century barbarian Muslims like the mullahs in Iran. And pit the one against the other. So I think this has to be done prudentially. And that's why I'm reluctant to say, you know, we have to get them to agree to this before they do anything else. Because my idea would be, how do you move these chess pieces on the table in the most effective way to advance goals that I think we're on the same page as to where we want this to go. We're just debating the proper tactics to get there.
Dinesh, thank you so much for being here. I want to encourage everyone to watch your new podcast called Dinesh, it's easy to remember, where you do deal with the moral order of the universe in so many ways. I thank you for being here at the Rabbi's Table. Chazak u'baruch. May you be strong, may you be blessed, may you and your family always be safe, blessed, healthy, and happy. And again, thank you for being here. Thank you for being at the Rabbi's Table.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.